Thanks for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, nationally syndicated and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. And you can see, if you're watching on Twitch.tv on our little high-def webcam there, that the great Daryl Hammond is now with us in studio. We're quite glad to have him. He's at the Punchline here in San Francisco. He has two shows tonight. He has two shows tomorrow as well. And we were just talking off the air about the time you got bumped by Mick Jagger on a character that you had been working on.
Well, you know, only for the week, you know, which is the way it runs over at SNL. 99% of the time, you don't get even 24 hours. You could get the part on a Wednesday, for instance, and not do it until Saturday, but you're working on other stuff. You don't have more than a handful of hours to put something together. But I put something together I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, Jagger comes in after Wednesday. And
it was for Karl Lagerfeld, the fashion guy.
Yeah. All right. And someone from Lauren's office comes up and goes, "Hey, Mick Jagger wants to play your part." I'm like, "Wait, what?" Mick Jagger says he does a great Karl Lagerfeld and he wants to play your part. And I'm like, "Mick Jagger?" She goes, "Yeah." "Wants to play my part?" "Yeah." "Good."
"Good." You got bumped by one of the biggest stars ever. So
I'm like De Niro in Goodfellas when he was like sampling Joe Pesci's mom's food. He's like, "Good."
I remember David Spade told the story, and then he's trying to write himself in, and he has nothing. He finally comes up with the guy at the mm-hmm. front desk, mm-hmm. and Bowie was on the show that day, and Bowie goes, "Oh, I like this. I'll be the guy going, and you are." And Spade said, "No." Mm-hmm. And so they just canceled it, and they had to bring it back a few weeks later. But he's like, "If I don't keep
very that, smart,
I'll have nothing."
Yeah. Very smart, because that was going to be a hit for him.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then he had Bye-Bye on the plane.
Yeah, but I mean, for him to say to Bowie, "No, you're going to be out of here, and I'm going to be back here looking for another hit character.
Right.
And I'm going to hold on to this one."
I always hear, because I listen to that Fly on the Wall podcast with Dana mm-hmm. Carvey and Spade, and that read-through, was it Tuesdays is the read-through?
Wednesday is the read-through. Tuesday is the all-day.
That's all the all-nighter. Okay. Right. But, like, trying to, you know, sometimes they would write the name of a sketch just to hear Lauren say it to make themselves laugh, you know.
No.
Like, "Tiny little baby wants a baby bottle booty." Something like that.
I have never heard this story, and yet it's got me smiling.
Now, can you... Even, I'm sure people have, count how many characters that you did over the years.
I don't think I can, you know, and I think if someone, you know, like I'm doing this thing for National Public Radio next week, where we're talking about doing impressions at SNL, and I want to, what's it called, stipulate, that I'm an SNL impressionist. With all the degrees of difficulty involved and the no time to learn this part thing.
Right.
And also, it seems to me I learned 100 that never even made it out of read-through.
Wow. What was your favorite one that, maybe you even got it in dress, but it never aired?
God, I don't know.
It was too many?
A lot. It's just a lot. Yeah. A lot.
So then, when you would hear, though, let's say you'd have De Niro, and you hear, would you, like, recuse yourself and just watch stuff and try over and over and over again, or did it just kind of come to you?
No, it doesn't come to me, and if it does come to me, it's because of work that I did in years past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it comes to me quickly, it's because I've done something like it before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all of this goes back to work that I started doing as a teenager. You know, and continued on and really buckled down on between the ages of 30 and 39 when I became obsessed with this idea. If I made one little improvement per week, would that snowball into something much, much bigger at the end of the year? And it turns out it does. You don't even have to make 52 improvements, even if you make 20 improvements in a year. I mean, it's stuff I got out of a book. I couldn't have thought of that on my own.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. That was the one that, I remember hearing Dana talk about when he met George H.W. Bush, and, mm-hmm. and Bush loved it. How did Clinton like your Clinton?
Well, he acted real nice to me, mm-hmm. just as nice as he could be. I mean, up to and including me walking, asking permission to attend one of his lectures before the California Bar Exam Association, which he did without a script and mentioned my name twice. It was a really heady experience. Hmm. You know, we were staying, it was in the same hotel I was in, and I called the front desk and said, will you please ask the Secret Service so I can come listen to the president talk? I mean, I'd already met him before,
mm-hmm.
and he was just as gracious as he could be. I think Cheney was the one that liked it best.
He did.
Cheney was a good laugher.
And that was the old, like, one side of the cheek, right, kind of thing?
Yeah, I made up a guy that that could be both sides of the aisle could laugh at. So I made up, we made up at SNL, this mm-hmm. wisecracking tough guy that mm-hmm. borderline, you know, on the penguin practice. But, you know, with the side leer,
uh-huh.
And it connected with both audiences, you know. I wasn't one of these guys. I mean, you know, we're sort of in a day and age now where you got to pick your side. You know,
yeah.
You're going to play Trump like Alec Baldwin or mm-hmm. or not.
And you, correct me if I'm wrong, did you think that you were going to be the guy being Trump and then Alec, and Lauren said, no, Alec's going to do it?
I mean, I don't exactly recall. There were different explanations offered, but the one that I kept getting was that they were getting into stunt casting.
And so now...
So they would mm-hmm. hire movie stars.
Mm.
You know. I mean, I had received quite a lot of attention internationally and gotten, you know, write-ups in major publications. And I think Daily Beast even called me America's Trump, and I was preparing for you know, this big town hall meeting with CNN, and I remember the day that it all got just snuffed out.
Wow.
And network TV, man, it's useless to complain about what happens at Gladiator Camp. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you're in the NFL, and you're like, that guy hit me a little bit too hard today. People all don't right. care. They don't want to hear that. No, the guy was really mean to me. He clotheslined me, man. I could clothesline today, dude.
The when you did Gore, was it you or Downey or Smigel who came up with Lockbox?
Well, Gore came up with Lockbox.
But I mean to emphasize it, though.
Jim Downey.
Yeah.
Like, I had been working on Gore for a year, taking him on stage at the Cellar literally 300 times, and I think I was doing a really accurate Gore. But at the time, you know, the only thing we knew about Gore was that he was a nice guy, works hard, does well. When you're flying under that flag, people just tend to leave you alone. It's like mm-hmm. elephants in Africa. You know, all those bad boys are out there eating everybody until the elephant walks out and they suddenly sort of settle down.
Right.
But so I had nothing. We had even taken him on in dress rehearsal. We're looking for a hook. So Downey and Gore supplied it. You know, as the sort of overbearing school teacher in the first debate of 2000, and Downey just picked that up and turned it into a franchise.
And did you meet Al Gore?
Yeah.
What did
several times.
What did he say about it?
He was a really good sport. I mean, I had someone from U.S. News and World Report tell me one day that I'd lost the election for him, and I took that to heart for a while.
Really?
Right, and there was another guy there from the Washington Post who goes, Gore didn't let Clinton campaign for him in Tennessee. He pretty much lost that one himself. Pretty much lost it. You know what I mean? He yeah. kind of lost it himself. He wouldn't let Clinton campaign in Tennessee.
Yeah, he lost his home state.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's rare. Even Mondale, when he lost 49-1, took Minnesota. I remember.
I mean, Clinton was a magician at the time. Still is. I guess if he ever wanted to be again, he probably could be, but you know, Clinton, like Trump, like Reagan, like Churchill, like Stalin, like Pol Pot, like Mao Zedong, understood that people want to feel before they think. It's more important to make them feel than think.
Mm.
You know, they'd rather be led. It's not that they want to be led by the nose, but when you're campaigning with them, they want you get them fired up about something.
Mm-hmm.
And
build a wall.
I mean, sure. I mean, or you were screwed.
Right.
You know, and, you know, and after that real estate, scam that was detailed in the movie, what was it?
The Big Short?
Big Short.
Mm.
I mean, he didn't have far to go with that one. You know, and so he comes in and he adopts some stuff from Huey Long in Louisiana, which was, it's not me they're after, it's you. I'm just in their way. And Trump can sell, man. And he sells that in 10 different ways. And that's the franchise there. That's the fish chum. I mean, when I was on Broadway with Michael Moore, I just did one night, and he wanted to call Trump stupid. And I said, do you really think cunning is not a form of intelligence?
Mm. No, it's true. We got to run to a break. We're going to come back in studio. We got another segment with Daryl Hammond. He is at the Punchline here in San Francisco. Two shows tonight, two shows tomorrow. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back with Daryl Hammond. All right, thank you for that. Welcome back to the show. Daryl Hammond is in studio with us. He's at the Punchline. We just got a guy text in saying, I haven't heard a Pol Pot reference for a while.
Uh-huh.
So he said, good pull, a Pol Pot reference.
Well, yeah.
Khmer Rouge. Let's spend the next segment just talking about
it. No, make them feel.
Yes, make them feel. We were talking about McCain, a guy who I admire very, very much, and not just because my dad was also a naval officer. I just always admired the guy and talked about his concession speech. Instead of being like Dukakis saying, this isn't over, he's like, this is a great day. We elected an African-American. He hosted SNL. Mm-hmm. I remember because that was the day the White Stripes were on.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great show.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Fred Armisen did his Venezuelan guy. Oh, I'm just kidding, guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were there. You talked to McCain a lot, right?
I got to talk to him a fair amount on two separate occasions. When I say a fair amount, I mean 5, possibly even 8 minutes,
mm-hmm.
10 minutes, like something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an affinity for him from jump, you know, and I didn't actually understand until my father died, who was a soldier, that's what that was about. And so I debuted, I think, a really nice impression of John McCain the year previous to his final presidential run. And I had I thought it was a nice McCain, and everyone else thought so too, and got well reviewed. But during that summer and the stuff about my dad, you know, my father, the end of his life was him saying, you know, I was a good soldier, and he was. But I wasn't the dad that I should have been. And to say that he had let his anger be more important to him than his children was a magical moment, like a God moment, where I got it. A soldier. He never really came home from fighting what he called verifiable evil. You know, the guy's not a religious guy, but he's talking about what I saw was biblical stuff, man.
Mm-hmm.
And to have fought that. Recently, I watched the most recent version of All Quiet on the Western Front,
yeah,
about World War I, and I realized my dad lived that. He was in that, you know. And then seeing my father wake up over the years with the nightmares and screaming and at night, not all the time, less and less as time went by, but it did happen. And then at the end of his life, to bond with him on that level, McCain wasn't someone I really wanted to play anymore. So you see in the following season, I can't do it. I can't do it. And, you know, part of impersonating someone is you exaggerate stuff about them, and one of those things is the body. I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
Wasn't going to do it. I couldn't do it. And to take the body out of an impression, you might as well kill the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ended up happening.
You've been well documented with your childhood and issues that you had with your mom as well. So just ask, how are you doing now with all that stuff?
How do I look? Do I look okay?
You look great.
Seem to be doing pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of shows this year, a lot of clubs, some casinos, some one-nighters. I've done a lot of performance.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with something like PTSD, it's a work in progress. It doesn't. It's sort of like emptying the ocean with a pail. You know, you still have to do, you know, your cognitive therapy stuff and my yoga stuff and my 12-step meetings and all of that stuff. There's cognitive therapy on your own, and then there's therapy with a doctor as well. And I've been at it a long time, and I feel like I've reaped the rewards of it.
Mm-hmm.
to me to have days where I'm comfortable, just comfortable, not joy jumps, not jumping up in the air shouting Eureka, astonishing. And it comes as the result of, I mean, decades of work and Lorne Michaels Health Insurance, if I'm to be frank.
Yeah. I remember Bill Hader saying that before every show, he would get physically sick and he had to go throw up. Mm-hmm. For you, the issues you were dealing with, like sometimes in between sketches, like wardrobe changing, I mean, how are you able to, I mean, it's amazing that you were able to conquer that and come through looking like you were just absolutely fine.
You know, Lorne Michaels has weird theories, interesting theories, things that I heard that he said, but apparently I'm good under fire.
Yeah, you like pressure.
Well, I know it. I know what it's like. Pressure mm-hmm. is a parent standing there with a knife that they intend to use on you. That's pressure. Not a scaffold falling on your head or something like that. I hate to be so dark about it, but mm-hmm. there it is.
But also, you still, and like I said, tell me if I'm wrong, you still loved your parents. It's not like you hated them, right?
It's impossible not to love your parents. I mean, it wasn't until the end of, the very, very end of my therapy and the very, very end of my mother's life when I got a full sense of all the things she had done. But in the treatment center that I was in, we made sure we understood where she came from, okay? How that she was not born this way. She was created, and she was created by horrific circumstances. And, you know, as the doctor said to me, and, you know, I wrote a play about it. It may or may not be mounted. I mean, they were going to mount it twice. It was at La Jolla Playhouse. Long story. You know, nothing frees you captive any faster than a little sympathy for the devil. When you feel some sympathy for them, and then you forgive them in the way that Martin Luther King describes forgiveness in his diary, you know, and it's not for them, it's for you to cut them loose and say, I'm sure there's a God and God will know what to do with this. This is not stuff a human can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, the title of your book, If You're Not Up There, God, I'm Effed, something like that?
Yes, God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed, and my second book I'm working on now called Monsters Also Cry.
Let's talk about something fun.
Sure.
Sean Connery, Suck It, Trebek, that whole thing. Did you ever think that that would take off like it did?
No. It was one of those ones, I'm thinking, you know, on the Tuesday night you mentioned earlier, I really had nothing. Oh, I just had nothing, man. The well was dry. My eye kept being drawn to this movie, The Untouchables, with Sean Connery.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's where I was at. I knew I should be working on something that I could probably get on the air, but I couldn't. I was just drawn. So I'm sitting in my office, and Will Ferrell's office is across the hall at that time, I believe. And I just was doing this over and over again. I'd go, you don't have to think about it, just nod. Don't have to think about it, just nod. You know, I'm not proposing marriage, you know, like that. And Will Ferrell was there, and it was just like this weird impromptu thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a fan of the ladies. I got your back. And a franchise was born. I remember the first time we went out there fully expecting. Because, I mean, the weirdest thing about it, the audience sort of has to understand your premise and kind of agree with it to laugh at it. That's why you would only get, in a room full of Democrats and Republicans, you might only get half the room.
Mm-hmm.
Because only half the room will agree. But here's something that no one would ever think to agree on. The Connery is stupid. Do you know what I mean? That he's homophobic, right, or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as Lorne Michaels said later, it was just so darn silly.
Yeah.
It was just so silly.
You and then Norm doing the Turd Ferguson, Burt Reynolds. Like, you two guys, I mean, it's just double crush right there.
I hadn't watched them for years, and someone encouraged me to watch them. And, you know, I think of some of the writers there, the Emmy winners all.
Yeah. Coming up with, that's not what your mother said last night, Trebek.
The last time Greg and I were in San Francisco, we were right around the financial district somewhere, and a guy comes out of a restaurant and yelled out, moo. I said, what is moo?
That's the sound your mother makes.
And I'm like, all these years later, in Chinatown, in San Francisco, you know, that's when you know you've hit something. It transfers cultures. You know, it's just like leapfrog, you know.
What is an impression of all the characters, you know, over 100 that you did?
For SNL.
SNL that you loved that got maybe a tepid response and you're like, oh, I nailed that. Come on.
I don't know.
Or just maybe one of your favorites, like you just love doing that guy.
Something weird happened when I was going to do James Gandolfini, and I thought I had a really good Tony Soprano. I was really happy with my Tony Soprano. And,
well, I got to hear a little bit now, please.
Well, you might.
Okay. Stand by.
And this was the night that the scaffolding fell on my head. This was the night I had glue in my eye. This was the night when the cue cards weren't ready. As we went to air, there was nothing to say.
Mm.
And I got so flustered, I confess, I just started doing like Marlon Brando. Mm. I was like, what am I, you know? I'm like, we're at the Bada Bing with, you know, I was like, no, that's not it. But it worked well enough to get the laugh.
So you were doing Marlon Brando doing Tony Soprano.
Something like that, but yeah. You can't cuss on this station, right?
No.
Because I had
over the air, yeah. We'll lose the Tulsa affiliate.
Okay. I just had a dinner with him one night, and he was asking me about
Brando or Gandolfini?
Gandolfini.
Wow.
He's asking me about my drinking, but I can tell you off the air, it was one of the best moments of my life.
Well, what were some of your like catchphrases that you had Gandolfini saying? Like that
I
you were
gonna recall it was the one night and okay. Was lost to a scaffolding.
Wow. Who was the guy, I want to say Jeff Daniels, maybe it wasn't him, but they put the plaster on him and he couldn't breathe and they said, if you throw up, you'll die.
Who was that?
He was a host. Maybe it was before your time. It's this legendary story. They wanted to get a mask of him and they put this plaster.
Yeah. What do they call that? I should know what they call
plaster
it.
Plaster of Paris or whatever?
It's a mask. It's it's like there are death masks for, they call them, but they're, I mean, it's just a plaster. It's a plaster of Paris mold of your face, which shows all extensions.
Death mask for Cutie.
Huh?
Something like that.
What?
That's a little death cab for Cutie joke. Daniel, we're going to roll it. We're going to come back. We'll have 3 minutes left with the great Daryl Hammond here at the Punchline. Come on back on Sports Byline. Can't thank Daryl Hammond enough for coming in. Make sure to see him tonight. Two shows at the Punchline. Two shows tomorrow night at the Punchline here on Battery Street. Let me throw this at you, Daryl. Someone who's in town playing the A's over in Oakland with the Texas Rangers is Bruce Bochy, guy who has 3 World Series rings.
Mm-hmm.
Your former high school baseball teammate?
And Babe Ruth League and American Legion.
Wow.
Yeah, and a guy that used to pitch to me, pitch batting practice to me, and just one of the most interesting fellows you'd ever meet in your life, just so quiet and so smart. And of course, seeing Bochy, who became a big league catcher, to see him play next to the ordinariness of me, of guys like me who tried so hard. Oh, my God, I have to let bat. I'm working out. Oh, I'm trying so hard. You know, and the first day we saw Bochy throw from behind the plate when he was 13 years old, we realized that this league won't be the same as it was.
Wow. So even then you could tell.
I think you could between 13 and 15. A guy that can throw a rope to second base has got a major league arm already. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it came from God.
Before we let you go, I believe it's 3 more years till the 50th anniversary party. First of all, how was the 40th?
The party?
Yeah.
I don't go to those parties.
Well, I just mean the show, when everybody got together. Even in the audience, everybody was famous.
It's so many moments at SNL I've given up trying to describe, you know, walking by a room where Archie and Peyton and Eli are discussing something in why another room where LeBron James is standing there. Pavarotti's down the hall. You can't, describing all of that, you know, Chappelle's coming in my dressing room, you know, looking for a bottle of water. I mean, the Super Bowl MVP, Von Miller, in Keenan's dressing room, like 12 feet from me. How do you describe it?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's a little bit like trying to comprehend the moon. I will say, the farther I get away from it, the better I'm able to understand how special
Absolutely special. And also check him out at the Punchline tonight and tomorrow, as I mentioned. Nate, great to have you in, man.
Hell of an interview, dude.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Hell of a damn good interview.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right, we got another hour coming back. I'm Rick Tittle. We'll see you in a second.